Board Game Bros. Hello, listeners.
Hi, everyone.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. And it's a regularly scheduled weekly episode this week. We are selecting one game that we are going to talk about in detail. We're going to first talk about how to play it. Then we're going to talk about how to win at it. And then we're going to talk about how it was designed. So, Matthew, what game are we talking about today?
We are talking about Coimbra, designed by Flaminia Brazzini and Virginio Gigli, and published in 2018 by Eggertspiel. And among awards, it had a few nominations at Golden Geek 2018.
Now, I will say that this game is actually pronounced Coimbra.
Coimbra.
This is a real name of a real city in Portugal.
Excuse me, then.
So, and technically, if you are so skilled with your mouth, you could hit that R with that little bit of staccato, like in Portuguese or Spanish. It's not necessarily a rolled R, I think, but it is, you know, a little fancy. But I can't do that, so I'm just going to call it Coimbra. All right. So, as a short description of Coimbra, in Coimbra, players play as the heads of Portugal's oldest houses, vying for influence in the country by forging relationships with powerful citizens and nearby monasteries. Over the course of four rounds, players will draft dice that will determine both how they acquire helpful characters, those are the influential citizens, and also what resource they collect at the end of their turn, be it money, military strength, points, or movement for their monk on the game board. Players may also pay for voyages overseas at the end of each turn. At the end of the game, after scoring bonus points for voyages, resources collected, and diplomas, which we'll talk about later, the player with the most points wins. So that's the gist of it. You draft dice, and then those dice will determine how the rest of the turn plays out. And the rest of that turn will involve paying resources to collect character cards, and then acquiring resources that you will use in later turns to collect character cards as well as other actions.
Right.
So let's get a bit deeper into the strategy. But first, let's get a little more specific about how the game is played.
Right.
And what it looks like. So let's describe the game board and the player boards. The player boards are very simple. They're pretty much only used to track how much resources you have. And organize your cards. And the card organization is purely just because certain cards have effects that will happen during different parts of a turn. And the player board helps you to organize your cards in that way so that the cards that all activate at similar times are bunched next to each other. The rest of the board is tracking your resources. There's two primary resources in this game, which is money and military power. And you have each player has a tracker that goes from 0 to 20. You can never have more than 20 or less than 0. And you use little cubes and slide them along the tracker to track how much you have at any given point. Now, the game board. There is a map on the game board that has a number of spaces for monasteries. The monasteries are represented by cardboard pieces that you place on the map in these slots. They have three tiers to them, tier one, tier two, and tier three. And for just a quick count of how many of each there are 8 tier one slots, 4 tier two slots, and 2 tier three slots. The game gives you more than that, so that every game you play is going to be slightly different, not only in arrangement, but also which ones actually get drawn. And in between all of these monasteries, there's a bunch of like interstitial points where you have this little monk token that will travel across the board, and they'll have to, you know, walk along these paths, and it'll take them a couple moves before they reach a monastery.
Right. And when they do reach a monastery, you place a little wooden disc of yours onto that monastery to show you have visited it, and you'll get a reward for visiting the monastery.
Right. Oftentimes, this reward will be a resource. It could be points. It could be something that happens at the end of the game, but or it could be something that happens when you visit other monasteries. or when you take certain other actions, but most likely it's just an immediate bonus. And then the other thing that it could give you is influence. And you track influence directly to the right of the map on the influence tracks. There are 4 influence tracks, and you could think of the different influence tracks as suits, because these will come up on the character cards that we describe in a little bit. So the influence tracks are for they're for council members, merchants, clerics, and scholars. And the colors are gray, gold, purple, and green. And each track not only represents these sort of concepts in these people that you are trying to befriend, but they also represent a specific type of resource. So the gray tracker, which represents council members, gives you military strength. The gold track, which represents merchants, gives you gold. The purple track that represents clerics gives you movement for your monk. And the green track, which represents scholars, gives you flat out points. So on these tracks, they each go from 0 to 15. And you start at 0. And as you acquire character cards, they will increase your influence, which means you get to slide a disc up these tracks to show how much influence you've gained with each of these facets of society. And every 3 that you obtain, there is a shift in the bonus that you get from scoring these influence trackers. So, for example, you start at 0 on the gold tracker. If you were to score your gold influence, then you would get 1 coin. If you were to have 1 to 3 influence, then you would get 3 coins every time you scored gold influence. And then it goes up from there. 4 to 6 is 5. 7 to 9 is 7, so on and so forth. At the very top, you will get 10 gold for having 13 to 15 influence on the gold tracker. But then you would also get bonus 2 victory points every time you score it. And similar things happen on the other trackers. The gray tracker is pretty much the same numbers. You get 10 military strength, 2 victory points. The monastery can move your monk up to 6 spaces at the very highest of the influence track. The scholar track, the green track, only goes just flat out points still at the top. It gives you 8 points every time you score it at the very top.
Right.
So these influence trackers also have spaces above them to place these scoring tiles. And there are 4 scoring tiles.
And 7 years ago.
Sorry?
Nothing. I was making a joke.
Okay, 4 score. I get it. So each scoring tile tells you how many points the player with the most influence, the second most influence, and sometimes the third most influence, depending on how many players are playing the game, get at the end of the game. So these are bonus points at the end of the game. The players that are furthest along the track will get these bonus points. And they are shuffled and dealt to these influence trackers because some of them give more points than others. I think the most points you can earn is 13, and then this is by being first in a tracker. It goes 13, 11, 9, 7. So being first in one of these tracks every game will give you 13 points and so on. Okay, right. There's 2 more parts to the board. The next important part is the city, which is where you will be going to acquire characters. This is on the far left side of the board. There is 4 locations in the city, and when we explain how the dice work, I guess it'll be a little more apparent what these do. But essentially, you will be drafting dice and placing them here, and you will place them in a certain row, and whatever row you place your die in, that will tell you like which character cards you can purchase from. It's sort of like a trade row, but you have to choose which row you buy from. And then the last part of the board is the voyage cards, which are 6 cards at the bottom of the board. These are kind of like objectives in Terraforming Mars, if you played that, where you pay money and you put a disc on a voyage. And then at the end of the game, you will get bonus points based on which voyage you funded or which voyages you funded, because it's possible to fund more than one.
Right. They also give other bonuses, don't they?
No, they only give points.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I thought I saw one that doubled the lowest influence tracker you had.
No, that gives you points based on double of your lowest
income. Oh, okay, cool. Yes. So there's just different methods at which they give you points.
Yeah, there's only one voyage that gives you flat points. Everything else gives you points based on some other part of your acumen.
Sure.
All right, so there's character cards, which I mentioned briefly. Each character card has a suit, which is one of the four influence trackers. They also have an influence number, which is how much they increase your influence when you purchase that card. They also have a resource cost. It doesn't tell you how much of the resource you pay, because those are determined by dice, but it does tell you which resource you pay, so that could either be gold or strength. And then they have effects. And the effects could be immediate effects, that you just gain some kind of resource immediately. They could be effects that happen during the end of your turn. They could be effects that happen as you acquire more characters. And they could be effects that happen at the end of the game, that like score you points at the end of the game.
Yeah.
The last thing that we need to talk about is the dice. And this is sort of a very central, integral part of this game that affects every other aspect of the game. And that's kind of why I saved it for last. I want to set up the scene for like how these dice work.
So they're bright in your memory.
Yes. Matthew, do you want to try to take the dice, or do you want me to take
it? I'll take it. So
okay.
Actually, one thing I don't remember is how many you roll every round.
You roll you roll all of them.
Okay.
Now, and all of them in a four-player game is 13 dice.
Per color?
13 dice, is it? Let me just double check this real quick. Yes. Okay. 13 dice. There's three per color plus one wild.
White. Yeah. And
now, hold on. But if it's a three player game, you take out one purple and one green. And if it's a two player game, I think you take out one of each color except for the white.
Okay. So you will have between, what would that be? 9 and 13 dice.
Yeah.
So you roll them at the start of every round. And the starting player drafts one of those dice,
mm-hmm.
and then it goes around in a circle.
Yeah, or it goes. It doesn't go around in a circle. There is a player order in this game that's determined by.
My bad.
Yeah, I guess that's one last part of the game board is there's order.
You have these little lions.
That so you don't really ever go clockwise or counterclockwise, at least for that reason. It's always determined by something else.
You know what? How about you take the rest of this? Because I've already made two mistakes.
Sure, no problem. Okay, so there's 13 dice. The dice can be five colors. There's the four colors that match the trackers, gray, gold, purple, and green. And then there's also a wild dice. There's three of each color, one wild. So at the start of each round, and this game takes place over four rounds, you roll the dice, and then in player order, you draft these dice and place them in the city. So when you draft a die, each player has these little plastic molded pieces that they slot the die into, and those plastic pieces match the color of all their other pieces, same color as your monk and your player order piece and your discs and your cubes. So you put your die in the little plastic holder, but without changing its face, because it's very important what face is face up when you draft that die. Then you place it in the city. The castle location, if you place it there, then you order all of the dice in that location from lowest to highest, because when we start to acquire things from the city, the castle will go from lowest to highest. The lowest die gets to choose first. In the castle, there are these tiles. They're called favor tiles in this game, and they give you some bonus for the rest of that turn. It could be resources, victory points, monk movement. And then the rest of the city is where you acquire character cards. There's the upper city, the central city, the lower city. Each one, there's really no difference mechanically from each other. It's just where the character cards have been dealt. And there are four character cards in each row. So you and in the rest of the city, the upper, central, and lower city, you go from high to low. So the person who places the highest die there gets to buy first. So players will take turns drafting these dice. Say there's a card in the central city that you very much want to acquire. Then you would probably want to draft a six, because a six will definitely get to buy first. That means that there's not no chance that other people won't be able to acquire the card that you want. So you draft a six, put it in your little standee, your little plastic molded thing, and you put it in the central city. And then everybody else who places dice there will have to go after you.
Right.
So this goes around until every player has drafted three dice, and then it'll go through the buying phase. So the persons in the castle from lowest to highest will choose the favor. Then from highest to lowest in the upper, central, and lower city, you'll start acquiring character cards. And you go from top to bottom. So the upper city happens first. People buy their cards there, so on and so forth. Now, the number that you drafted, the number on the die that you drafted that's face up, that is how much money or how much resources you have to spend to acquire a card.
Right.
So if you're trying to acquire a character card that costs gold and you drafted that six, then you have to pay six gold to acquire that card. If you are trying to acquire a card that costs power and you drafted a two, then you have to pay two power to acquire that card.
Right.
And you go top to bottom so that, say, you spend a lot of gold on a card in the upper city. Maybe when it comes to the lower city, you might be forced to buy a card that costs gold and you might not have enough. In that case, and in a case where you just don't want to acquire a card anyways, you can choose to take two of each resource, two gold and two power, instead right. of drafting a card. So this happens. People acquire all their cards. They take all their dice back. Now it comes to the scoring phase. And the way that this works is that in player order, players will score their influence tracks that match the color of the dice that they drafted. So right. if you drafted a gray die, then that means you score your gray tracker. So wherever your influence marker is on that tracker, you see the corresponding reward in resources, and you collect that for every gray die that you drafted. And you do the same for gold and for purple and green. Now, this part happens in any order you choose. And usually that means that you want your purple to score first, because your monk could possibly land on a monastery that increases your influence on another tracker. And you want that to be higher for when you score that.
Mm-hmm.
So after everyone scores these influence spaces, then you check the new player order. Which is determined by crowns. There's just different things in this game that have crowns on them, and whoever has the most gets to go first the next round. The right. player order tracker has crowns on them. The people at the bottom have the most crowns. So that kind of will flip the scales of things on its own, but yeah. there's other ways to get crowns.
The favor tokens, three of them have crowns as well. Yes.
And then certain cards in the city that you acquire can give you crowns. They'll be like extra crowns that just get put on certain cards. And then at the end of the turn, before you start the next turn, people can choose to purchase a voyage. And you can only purchase one voyage each turn. So if that's your only method of acquiring voyages, then you can only have up to four. But there's ways of acquiring more.
Yeah.
So I think that's everything there is to say about how to play Coimbra in detail.
I believe so.
So now I'm going to talk about strategy. And I'm going to break it down in three categories, because there's three main things that you're looking at here. There's characters, monasteries, and voyages, because these are how you, you know, acquire resources and increase your influence and score points. So just to break this down very simply. The character cards are separated into three groupings. And so the character cards, there's a set one. There's a first set that people start with at the beginning of the game. These are like dealt to players. Not really. They're dealt in pairs, and then players draft those pairs.
Right.
So you get to choose which of the first set cards that you get, in a way. And some of these first set character cards can reduce the costs of cards you acquire. There's one that will reduce the cost of any card you acquire that costed power by one. And there's the same thing for coins. It'll reduce the cost of any card you acquire that you paid coins for by one. These are probably the most valuable tier one cards.
Right, they can add up over the course of the game.
Yeah, they can add up. The second most valuable is one that gives you four resources of a given type, either four coins or four shields, because those two will also give you two influence in the same tracker. So the four coin will give you two influence in the gold tracker. These are pretty good. The rest are less good, although it depends on the rest of the game, and you can't really plan for that. So I'd say look for those two. Otherwise, just get what you can.
Right.
Tier two,
or the second set of cards. So the rest of the cards, they come in two decks, the tier two deck and the tier three deck. They get shuffled, put on top of each other, but you're going to go through all the tier two cards before you get into the tier three cards in this game, because there's 24 of each, and the board holds 12, and you refresh the board after every turn, and there's four turns. So the best tier two cards to get are the ones that give you three influence in any given influence space. Even the best cards to get are the ones that give you three influence in the influence tracker that gives you the most points at the end of the game.
Right.
Because obviously you're trying to get the most points, and being at the top of the influence tracker that gives the most points, and even being, you know, at the top of the second most points too, if you can manage it, is a very, very valuable strategy.
Right. Yeah. And remember that the three influence amount is enough to get to the next tier.
Right.
Or at least it's one before the next tier. Either way, the tiers are in groups of three.
Right. So the most influence you can get from a tier two card is three. So yes, these three will get you into the next bracket. Or these cards that give you three influence will get you into the next bracket.
Right.
The effects of the tier two cards for the most part are less good. There's some tier two cards that will give you bonus points based on where you ended up on certain influence trackers. So for example, there's one that says, like, if you're in the highest gray bracket, you get 10 points. If you're in the second highest gray bracket, you get 7 points. If you're in the third, you get 5 points. These can be good, but they're not really a guarantee, unless you can get the one that's worth the most points at the end of the game for having the most, because you can kind of like force that and get that. Now, the other effect that's pretty good in tier two is there is an effect that says at the end of your turn, when you're scoring your influence trackers from your dice, you get to increase any one tracker by 1 point. So overall, this is going to increase your tracker by 3 or 4 points, which is pretty good. But it also means that sometimes you might fall like 1 point short on the tracker for the next bracket, and this will just kind of take you over that hump on certain turns, which can be very good. The rest of the effects are kind of negligible. You just kind of get whatever seems the most valuable to you. Like, yeah. If you're just barely away from a monastery, you can get one that moves your monk. If you're running low on resources, you can get cards that increase your resources. But overall, influence is king in the tier two cards. Yep. So now you get into the tier three cards, and this is just shoring up that influence tracker, or the two influence trackers that you're trying to have the most influence in, to get those points at the end of the game. So continue to draft or to acquire cards that give you those. But then the rest is just value, because a lot of the tier three character cards will be affected by the other cards and the other actions that you've taken throughout this game. For example, there's one that says you get 5 points for every full set of each character card suit that you have. So there's four colors. So for every, you know, set of each color, you get 5 points. If you have multiple, that's a really good card. There's one that says you can reactivate the immediate effect of another gray character card. So you get like double value from a previous card. That's good value.
Mm-hmm.
There's a card that lets you pay three coins or three power to acquire a card from the discard. So that's two cards in one. That's good value. So you're really just looking for good value in your third tier cards, other than trying to finish up getting to the highest bracket of one or two different influence spaces.
Yeah.
That's character card strategy. Okay, monastery strategy. Monasteries are very powerful because they oftentimes do just as much, if not more, than scoring an influence track. And so drafting purple dice is very good because that means you get to visit the monasteries more often, which means that you're kind of doing like two things at once. You're visiting a monastery and you're doing something else like getting three gold or getting three power. Now, there is one monastery that is more powerful than them all in tier one, and that is a monastery that gives you a point every time you visit another monastery.
Yeah.
Because this is just value on top of value. Visiting a monastery is already a very good thing to do because it's almost just as good as getting gold or getting power or getting points. But this thing, this extra, having this monastery, having a disc on this monastery means you'll get an extra point on top of that. And that can really grow over the course of a game.
Right.
You go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's one of those things where, like, you know, if you get it early enough, then it doesn't seem like much, but it will put you ahead by a significant amount.
Right. We often talk about build-arounds in games, and sometimes there's build-arounds that aren't worth the effort, and sometimes there's build-arounds that are risky, but they can pay off. But in this case, this is just a build-around that's very easy to do and very easy to pay off on.
Yeah.
There, the rest of the tier one monasteries, some of them do give you influence. Those are very good. Some of them give you resources. Those are also good. The tier two monasteries aren't so good. Here you're just going for value again. So if there's a tier two monastery that gives you a lot of points, just go for it. If there's a there's one tier two monastery that gives you resources, that's probably very valuable. Tier three monasteries is where you get into some of the build arounds again. There's one that lets you get 2 points for every monastery you visited when you visit it. There's one that lets you get there's one that lets you immediately score an end of game card and a influence track point bonus. So if you're particularly far ahead on the valuable influence tracker, you can immediately score it by going there. There's one that immediately lets you score 2 voyages, and there's one that lets you score your points from diplomas. Diplomas. That's one thing we haven't talked
about.
Yeah. I'll explain it in one sec. It's very simple. With diplomas, there's 5 colors of diploma that will appear on character cards and also sometimes on monasteries. Actually, there's wild card diplomas on monasteries to help you finish sets. But each set is worth a different number of points depending on how many cards or how many colors you have in the set. A set of 5, so one of each color, is worth 12 points. 4 is 8, 3 is 4, 2 is 2, 1 is 1. There you go, diplomas.
Yeah.
Diplomas seem like a build around because if you have all 5, if you have 2 sets of 5, that's 24 points. That's a lot of points in this game, but that's very difficult to pull off, and usually the effort is just not worth it. That is a bad build around in this game.
Right.
Okay, so that's monasteries. If you can get the monasteries that benefit from you visiting other monasteries, there's also a voyage that benefits from visiting a lot of monasteries, then go for it. Monasteries are very valuable. There's a lot of value in monasteries. Otherwise, there's still value even without the build arounds. There's still value in visiting lots of monasteries, especially ones that give you influence and resources. All right, last thing is voyages. With voyages, you just want to make sure that whatever you're investing in the voyage, you're getting at least that many points back. So if you spent 8 points, you want to get 8 points back, because at the end of the game, essentially every resource you acquire, so all the coins, the shields, and also the crowns technically for that turn, they're all worth a half a point at the end of the game. You add them all together and you divide by 2. So if you're getting more than a half a point for every gold you invest or every power you invest in a voyage, then that's a profit.
Yeah.
In points. But you would hope to get more than that. And each voyage has a different cost, and you can kind of figure out how much you can potentially get from each voyage every turn. So there's also ways to reduce the cost of voyages. So when you can do that and get more than, you know, double your investment in points, then that's a good thing. That's it. That's the strategy of Coimbra.
All right, so let's get into the design.
Yes.
So, first of all, I thought it was kind of funny. I don't know about, like, the back of the box, but the Board Game Geek description mentioned the dice as, like, a main focus. Like, it was an entire paragraph devoted to the dice mechanic.
Yes. On the back of the box, it talks about how the dice mechanic is a very, like, interesting, integral part of this game.
Right. So, a sort of useful starting point for designing games, if you don't know, like, how to start or where to start, is to pick something as, like, an anchor or a focus and design around it. That way it has, like, this element of cohesion to it. And in this case, you could definitely tell it was the dice because everything revolves around the dice, or at least the dice have, like, a ton of different purposes.
Yeah, they have a ton of applications in this game.
Right. So, first off, my favorite one is the inverse scaling of points to pick order when it comes to the cards, or coins to pick order, price to pick order. You see, it seems a bit more common in nowadays with, like, where things that let players make choices sooner make them spend more resources.
Yeah.
Just because it balances out pretty nicely. That
you could also kind of talk about, or can say it like, players that get to choose what they want have to pay more. They have to get what they want, they have to pay more.
That being able to make a choice and have the intended outcome is a premium. Or, like, letting your strategy play out precisely is a premium. And this is just a really elegant way to do it. Like, it only uses one component, and it does so in a intuitive way.
Mm-hmm.
It has a lot of applications because, like, you know, it still has the element of, like, you could try and pick a lower number to, you know, guess that the opponents won't pick something. And that automatically, like, adds an element of reading that adds skill to it.
Right.
You know, like, for the most part, anything where there's a chance that, like, guessing what the other player's strategies might be, where if there's, like, a chance that can help, then usually that mechanic just adds to the skill. And as long as that's not, like, necessary for the mechanic to function, it doesn't take away from the skill floor too much.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
It balances demand, like we said, that the more popular stuff are more pricey. Just sort of another sort of interpretation of that.
Mm-hmm.
I think the way income works is interesting as well, because, it feels like early in the game, like at least round one, you're not picking dice for their color. I could be wrong, but it feels like that. You're like...
It depends. Because, yeah. Well, I think in the early game... I mean, the gold and the gray dice, which give you the resources that you spend on cards, are kind of important in the early game because you want to make sure that the next turn you can draft those higher numbers and get those cards that you want.
Right.
Maybe that's probably better on the second turn rather than the first turn, because after the second turn you start to get into the tier 3 character cards.
All right. Well,
and then the purple dice are important at any stage if you're approaching a monastery that gives you a pretty big bonus.
Well, then I guess a good way to put it is, like, the picking for color and picking for number are kind of at odds with each other, because sometimes you want to pick for a number, but I mean, obviously if it's a color you don't need, then it's a color you don't need, but you might need to pick for a given influence track and then pick for a number the next turn. So, like, the color and number are kind of at conflict, which adds more room for decision making.
Right. Which Although is sometimes it can make the decision for you, because you'll say, like, oh, I want the highest number, and there's 3 sixes. So maybe I just take the gold six because I need money after this.
True.
I'm about to spend 6 coins. I'd like to get those coins back.
That's true. It is also worth noting that picking a lower number on a die means that you could use that die to get the favor token that gives you more castles.
Mm-hmm.
Which means that there's a better chance that you'll go first next round.
Oh, you mean more crowns.
That's right. That's what I meant. More crowns.
Right.
So, like, it also kind of functions as a turn order catch-up mechanic that way.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm realizing, you know, when I played this game just recently, I was kind of a little more gung-ho about spending my money on the cards that I wanted. But after examining it and then doing this podcast, and I mentioned, you know, during the character strategy portion that really the influence is one of the more important things about, you know, the character you acquire. There's not a lot of characters with high influence, so, you know, you do have to spend a good amount of money to get that in the second phase of the game. But, you know, there could be a strategy to just drafting a bunch of low numbers and then spending very little money on character cards. You know, if you can assume that each character card is relatively balanced, they're probably not. There's definitely certain cards that are slightly better than others. But, you know, if that, you know, range and balance isn't too vast, then it probably wouldn't be a terrible time if you just drafted low numbers, acquired characters for very cheap, and then saved your money so that you could, you know, either trade it in for points at the end of the game, or you could go on more voyages with it.
Yeah. I think one thing is that, like, classically, a lot of games would have high numbers on dice be better.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a rare instance of, like, a game where both extremes are good in different ways. Which is neat.
Yeah. It's cool that they've managed that balance with still only dice. Like, they didn't add anything else to it. I would like to talk about, if you don't mind, I'd like to talk about how elegant is too elegant in this game's case.
Oh, well, I wanted to say one more thing.
Okay, go ahead.
Which was that the dice are, like, one of the main 3D objects in the game. Like, it's the main one you're interacting with and touching and moving. And it's especially fun to put it in that little dice compartment, or that dice stand. But
The dice stand is just this little, like, molded piece. It looks like castle. Is it called parapets?
Yeah.
You know, the top of a castle wall that just kind of holds your dice. Your dice just kind of nestles in it.
Or trellises or whatever, yeah. But I was going to say, but all that stuff about it being, like, fun and tactile fits with the fact that they're so important to the game.
Right.
You know, it gives it extra emphasis.
Certainly, this game is like a... It's like a masterclass in component design, both mechanical design and physical design.
Right. So back to what you were saying.
Okay. Elegance. How elegant is too elegant? So because they pull off a lot with just these dice. The dice mean a lot. Go ahead.
I was going to say really quick elegance to provide a definition.
Okay.
I would say it is a mixture of efficiency and lightweightness and intuitiveness. Mm-hmm. So, like, a mechanic or a component or whatever that's easy to understand, has multiple purposes, and is, like, small and unobtrusive.
Right.
That is elegance when it combines those options.
Right. So in this game, the dice are the definition of elegant.
Yeah.
Because so every die you draft does 3 things. It tells you the order that you acquire your cards in, it tells you how much you pay for those cards, and it tells you what you score at the end of the turn. And it does this in very intuitive ways. The higher numbers get to pick first, you pay what the face says, and the color of the die corresponds to the color of the tracker that you score. So it's checking all the boxes. But because it does this, there's nothing in this game that lets you you know, readjust the decision that you made at the beginning of the turn. When you draft a dice at the start of a turn, you are making so many decisions at once with so much like deducing and reasoning behind them. And in this game, when I've played it, and I've only played it with like one play group, so I can't say that this is true for everybody, but it seems like when a player has to pick their first die, it's a very complicated decision and they take a long time on it.
Right.
Because you have to make all of those decisions while also trying to deduce what your opponents are going to do, because you don't know what they're going to do. You don't know whether they're willing to spend a lot of money, get a very high costed die, and outbid you on another thing or race you to another card. And even if they do, it's not necessarily guaranteed that you know which card they're going to buy and which card that you can get away with buying for less. So right. You're making all of these decisions and you're deducing all of these things with just a single choice. And that single choice is picking a die and placing it in the city.
Yeah.
So is that too much? In this game, I would argue it's pushing it.
Right. This game can take a while because of those really lengthy decision-making processes, even though it's only four rounds.
I mean, it's like, it's almost the whole game is picking a die. Picking four dice or picking 12 dice. And this game has like almost no function to like help you change your mind, you know, after you've kind of locked it in. The only thing you can do is decide to buy a different card, which you might be forced to do anyways because somebody else bought the card you wanted.
Or discard it for two or discard points. Or two resources.
The other thing you could do is there is a wild die, which lets you choose which influence tracker you score at the end of the turn. So that could help you, you know, change your mind if you draft it and you think like, you know, I was going to do this, but now I think I should do this because I ended up having to buy two cards that cost gold and now I'm hurting for gold. So I'm going to use my wild card die to get more gold.
Right. So
that can help you adjust, but there's only one of those dice in this game.
So I think a problem is this game puts a lot of important information at like the start of a round right before you make that decision. Cause a lot of games will have some amount of like crossover time where one player can make a decision while other players are interacting with the game, or at least you can think about it. Like, you know, there's strategy games where you can't feasibly start planning until another person takes their turn. And then there's games where you can plan out some amounts or at least like have a few ideas before you go into your turn. But in this game, like you flip over and place the character cards, and then you roll the dice, and then you have to make the decision. So there's like 12 character cards that you have to decide, and then you have to figure out which ones you want to buy, which dice you'll need for the price or the order, and all that. And you can't preview any of those until that start of the round.
Right, yeah.
So
just a whole lot of information gets presented to you, and right away you have to make a very important
So yeah, I don't think it's the like elegance is the problem. I think it's the round structure and how much information it gives you at once.
That's a good point.
Just sort of an information overload. Yeah. So the monastery board.
Yes.
I looked over it and like mathematically every monastery is very particularly spaced between each other. Mm-hmm. So like the distance between any given tier monastery, so tier 1 to tier 2, tier 1 to another tier 1, is pretty much the same, or it's ratioed the same. So like there's 8 tier 1s and 4 of them are directly next to another one. There's four pairs that are one space away, and then each of them is also two spaces away from another one. Mm-hmm. It's 3 points from any given tier 1 monastery to a tier 2. It's 5 points from a tier 2 to a tier 3. It's 3 points between any given tier two. But the one problem I have is physically it doesn't match up. So, okay. If you look at the monastery track on the left side, it's a tier three and a tier three, and it is 7 spaces between them. And on the right side, it's a tier two to a tier two, which is 3 spaces between them, but physically it's the same distance on the board.
Sure.
So I just think that when it comes to like mechanical elements that involve space, in this case it's spaces on a board, usually it's a good idea to try and make it fit physically so that like you can glance at the board and have a more intuitive understanding of it from just that quick right. glance, because you'll see these two spaces are far away, that must mean mechanically they're far away.
Right. I think we've talked about this before, how like just the visual arrangement of things can help players intuit the mechanics behind it. And right. yeah, in this case, you know, I'm not sure if I mean, obviously they're working in a pretty limited space because there's spaces at a premium on this board.
Mm-hmm.
There's a tracker, there's places to place dice, and there's the voyage cards. So there's a place to place like 6 whole cards.
Yeah.
At the bottom of the board, there's places that have to fit up to 12 dice. And then there's a whole tracker that has to fit discs and still be legible. So then you're left with, there's also the score track, which is a border that goes around the map and the influence tracker, but not the voyages or the castle. Those lie outside of it, which is interesting. A score track that doesn't go around the perimeter of the whole board.
Yeah.
But so you're dealing with this limited amount of space. And then of course they only have 2 tier 3, you know, spaces.
Yeah.
I could see maybe they would put them like, rather than like in the corners of it, they could just put it at the top and bottom and then kind of fit everything else in between.
Right. Well,
now there might also be some kind of actual geographic.
Yeah. I'm not familiar with the geography of Portugal. I wouldn't be surprised if that were the case, but it still doesn't make for an intuitive layout.
Yeah.
I think also, like, a lot... I guess this makes sense that a lot of the monasteries are clustered on the right side, where it's more inland, versus mm-hmm. the left side. It's sort of like they're arranged in a K shape, a backwards K, where there's a straight line on the right and, like, sort of an inward angle on the left.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, if you could have, like, swapped the top left tier 3 with the top right tier 2 and like move some of the stuff around to make the ones more of a circle around the center, mm-hmm. and then made the tier 2s more of a square around the circles.
Now, I will say another thing about this, the map and how you move around it, is it's very rare that you approach like multiple tier 2s and a tier 3 in a given like game. Or at least if you hit a good amount of tier 1 spaces and then you go to the tier 2s and the tier 3s. You know, when I played recently, I kind of focused on that kind of thing, and I ended up only visiting 1 tier 2 and 1 tier 3. The other people I was playing with, they managed to reach like all 8 tier 1s, but only 1 tier 2.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's probably not often that you're going to go from tier 2 to tier 2. Also, the effects of the tier 2 monasteries aren't very important or very good. So it's very rare that you'd want to go from 1 tier 2 to another. You'd rather go from a tier 2 to a tier 3, so you'd be just kind of heading to that corner.
Right.
And all of the tier 2s are, like you said, 5 spaces away from a tier 3. It's, yeah. If you kind of group them visually like that, like the 2 tier 2s at the top and the 2 at the bottom are just in proximity to a tier 3, then that makes it make a little more sense.
But right.
I still get what you're saying.
Yeah. It's a weird case.
Right. That are it's a only weird three case spaces away.
Where the map is better understood when you abstract the map and like get rid of the physical location.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you look at it purely in numbers, it makes sense, but yeah. But you know, like I said, if there is a geographical sort of like what's it called? A geographical reference precedent. then let us know.
Yeah. Let's see. Other than that, I'll say that this is a very, very beautiful looking game.
The art is nice, yeah.
Yeah, they have a great color palette. You know, I don't know how to describe it. It's kind of soft, but still very vibrant. Yeah. The illustrations look very nice, and very uniform.
It sort of is like
the characters look like they belong in the city and on the map, and you know, everything just kind of unified.
Yeah,
the details are kept to a minimum in most cases.
I think there's
still some style to like card borders, but it's more subdued in this
right
game.
They definitely like in the parts that are mechanically relevant, they went with typical graphic design, less is more type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And but then they still added like flair where they could.
Sure. There is in the
backgrounds of the influence tracks, there's a little pattern.
Yeah.
But the symbols themselves are pretty simple.
Although there is a bit of like translation that needs to be done with certain effects.
Yeah.
On the cards, because they don't use text.
Right. It has the Seven Wonders problem.
Yeah. The only case when they use text is when an opponent has to give you something, or an opponent loses something. It'll say each other player or each opponent does this.
Yeah.
But everything else is represented by symbols.
I guess they just didn't have a symbol for opponents.
They have a glossary of effects at the back, and most of the cards can be grouped with other cards, so it's kind of easy to find, you know, what you're looking for back here in the back of the book, rule book, mm-hmm. to see what a card does. But it does have to be referenced, especially in a new group. It probably has to be referenced every turn.
Yeah.
To understand what each card does.
I think the thing that bothers me is with the ones that, you know, do something for each other player, they've shown that they can fit text on these cards in a readable format. Mm-hmm. So it just kind of bothers me that they wouldn't use that more for the more complicated icons that don't appear anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the cards that have text are some of the more busy cards.
True.
Visually. So I'd say it looks nice that they just use the icons. And after you've played the game once, you just kind of understand what they mean. And it's not a problem after that.
Yeah, it makes that first playthrough
slow.
And I
guess, like we talked about with the, you know, the ability to understand what's going on and to help make that decision when you're drafting a die, having to look up what a card does before making that important decision also will slow down the game a bunch.
Yeah.
All right. I think we've covered everything I have to say.
Yeah, I don't have anything else to say.
I do have one more thing
to
say about this game that's very cool, and that is that there's, you know, speaking a little bit more about elegance, there's a little more, there's a bit more strategy elegance in this game than in most games. Just because there's a lot of cards and monasteries and voyages that score you points based on some other trackable thing, like the number of cards of a certain suit or the number of cards that give you a certain amount of influence, and the number of monasteries you visited. So this game has a lot of build arounds
right.
at all stages of the game. There's tier one monasteries that care about monasteries. There's tier two cards that care about the influence trackers. There's the influence trackers themselves, which are kind of a build around with the points they give you. There's all the voyages, which each voyage is a different sort of build around. And I think that's very cool.
Oh, yeah.
It's such a modular game. Like, the board is modular. The pieces are, they're not necessarily modular, but they're elegant. And then the strategies are very elegant and modular.
Right. This is
it all comes together in a very cool way.
Yeah, this is a personal thing, but I personally like strategy games where people can compete on different axes, but still have like similar, you know, viability. Like, you mm-hmm. could build around a voyage, you could build around monasteries, you could interact with characters more than monasteries. And I also, in that regard, it does feel kind of roguelite-ish, where every portion of the game kind of connects with everything else. Everything can play off each other.
I'm not sure I follow you there, but
Well, you know, character cards can influence Monastery Tracker. That can influence. The influence can affect your voyages, which can affect influence in monasteries. And it's
is very interconnected because it cares about all the other parts of this game.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's very cool. And it lets you kind of formulate interesting strategies as you play. Yeah. And for the most part in this game, they're balanced well enough that each of them is valid. Everything except for diplomas.
Okay.
All right. So that's all we have to say about Coimbra. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
If you like what you hear, you can follow us. Well, you can leave us a comment, like us, leave us a review on any podcasting platform. You can follow us on social media at BG Bros Cast on Facebook and Twitter. You can suggest games or topics that you'd like to hear us discuss there. You can go to our website, bgbcast.com, where we post all our episodes and tag them. I mentioned Terraforming Mars. We did an episode on that game.
I mentioned Seven Wonders.
You mentioned Seven Wonders, yeah. So if you're interested to hear our thoughts on those games, you can check them out on our website. We tag all our episodes with the games that we discuss in them, so just search through those tags.
I was going to say, for a related game, we also covered Role Player, which is another dice drafting game.
Oh, yeah. Role Player is a very similar dice drafting game. So check those out on our website via the tags. If you don't see what you're looking for, then just hit us up on social media. And if you don't see a game that we haven't talked about yet, let us know. It's also on our website. You can find a link to our TeePublic store. That's teepublic.com/users/BGBcast, where we have t-shirts and stuff with a cool logo on it. Hit us up if you have ideas for merch that you'd like to see. And that does it for BG Bros Plug, so let's hear it from Matt Plugs.
I stream on twitch.tv/twack, that is twitch.tv/twak. I stream on most weekdays from 11 a.m. Central Time to 2 p.m. Central Time, give or take an hour. I stream a lot of competitive games, a lot of roguelites, sort of a mix of things. I speedrun, what have you. And also through that channel, you can find a link to a Discord server where you can chat with both of us, you know, ask us questions about the podcast, about games, about the stream, what have you. I also announce when I go live on that Discord server, as well as on my Twitter account at Matt Craig Gaming. And you can also follow me there and message me there.
All right. That does it for Matt Plugs, and that does it for our episode. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.
See ya.